Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Well, hello everyone from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio. We hope everybody's having a great week. We've enjoyed some wonderful weather in the Midwest. Here in western Indiana, it's been absolutely phenomenal, and we thank Mother Nature for that. But I'll tell you, tonight's guest, their winter has been a little bit different than we've enjoyed here in Indiana. We're going up to Alaska, Denali National Park and Preserve, and returning to the show once again, the gal that knows all about the largest park of North America, Chris Pfister, is going to be with us. We're going to talk a little bit about wildlife and snow and all the things involved with managing this fantastic area in Alaska. As always, handling the technical responsibilities, our studio producer, Melissa Hovey, and Wayne Larson, technical engineer. Scott Carney is taking over the musical chores tonight, and from the massive Wild World News studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, the honorable, distinguished, and always humble, and somewhat regular, Dr. Henry Day.
Nice of you to mention that. Good evening, Mr. Batson.
My pleasure. Well, how are things in Indianapolis, Dr. Day?
Well, pretty good tonight, I'd say. We're hitting around 58 degrees. How are things there at the Batson Wildlife Preserve? Are all your flowers coming up?
The flowers are coming up. It's raining a little bit tonight just to give the plants and everything a little drink of water. Absolutely perfect rain. We've seen no mushrooms yet, though. I was out 2 days ago and didn't wander into one, which is quite unusual. So I think the mushrooms are on the same clock they are every year, and they've ignored this little bit of early warm weather.
Well, that's gold in your country.
It truly is.
Now, have you seen a hummingbird yet?
No, I have not seen a hummingbird.
Let me know, because it's usually a week or so when you see them before they show up here.
Well, the magical date for hummingbirds in this part of the country, we have one species of hummingbird, ruby-throated hummingbirds, is around April the 14th or 15th, and that's usually when they show up. And then it's gangbusters till Labor Day, and then they head back to wherever they hang out for the winter. I don't have a clue.
Cancun.
Cancun. Yeah. Well, that'd be a good little flight for the little guys. The following portion of Larry Batson's Wild World is brought to you by Alphabet Swamp, the new children's book by Cheryl and Larry Batson. Order your autographed copy today at www.larrytheanimalguy.com or send check or money order for $10 per copy to Sharpen Those Pencils, WES 4140 North, 600 West, Greencastle, Indiana, 46135. Shipping and handling is included.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News for March 29th. Now, our first story tonight sounds like cat burglars to me. Honolulu, Hawaii. Authorities are searching for three exotic birds and the suspects who cut holes in their cages at the Honolulu Zoo. Now, a groundkeeper spotted the holes and plugged them with trash bags to prevent more birds from flying away. Now, a hand-fed gray tawny frogmouth,
yeah,
a brown ground dove, and a red parrot are missing.
That's too bad. Well, how did they repair their facility?
With a trash bag.
Oh,
that was just temporary, you know, so they didn't lose any more birds.
I gotcha.
That's an interesting combination of birds, you know, for someone to cut a hole in the cage. And sounds like a cat to me with wire clippers.
Yeah, right. And I would love to see the person's face when he comes across the frog mouth, the tawny frog mouth, because that is the most, that is the wildest looking bird you'll ever see. They'll think it's from another planet.
I have to agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a strange creature.
It is.
And the sound that they make, I think maybe the neighbors will be turning them in before too long. Let's hope so.
Yeah, if it, yeah, it should show up fairly quickly, I assume.
Now, do you remember the song Nashville Cats by the Lovin' Spoonful?
I certainly do. Great.
Well, this has nothing to do with that. Nashville, Tennessee. Four clouded leopard cubs will be on display this summer at the Nashville Zoo.
Oh.
Now, that's pretty exciting. The endangered cubs were born in two litters. Two were born on February the 13th and two on March 11th. Now, the four will be joined by a female cub who was born at the National Zoo in Washington.
Mm.
Now, the Nashville Zoo is one of only three in the United States that is breeding the clouded leopards, and they are beautiful creatures.
You know, and they're one of the most difficult cats to see in the wild next to the snow leopard, because they live in the tropics of Borneo, Sumatra, Indonesia. And because, of course, the snow leopard lives in the Himalayas. So, but, yeah, those are extraordinary animals. I would love to use one as a lecture animal.
Oh, I bet you would.
Oh, my God.
And the kids would love that, too.
Oh, that'd be incredible.
All right, we're off to the U.S. territory, Guam. Two Marianas kingfisher chicks were born at the Department of Agriculture, being the newest victory in the battle to revive an endangered species from the brink of extinction. Now, at least one of the chicks is female, and we'll find out about the other here soon.
Well, keep us up to date. Put your staff on that.
I shall do that. They're aware of it already.
Oh, good.
All right, she's not wild yet, but she could be. Big title for a small pup. Weighed 1 ounce at birth, Beyonce, a puppy, is vying for the title of the world's smallest dog. Now, her mother, Casey, a dachshund and a chihuahua mix, live in New York. Now, animal researchers say Beyonce could fit into a spoon when she was born.
My goodness.
Yes.
I'm not going to get on my soapbox about those little dogs.
I know. We had to report it, though. It's possibly the smallest in the world.
Well, that's
all right.
Exciting.
Little Rock, Arkansas. Son, it's time to go. The first gorilla to be born at the Little Rock Zoo is leaving home. Zoo officials say 5-year-old Mosey will eventually start to challenge his father, Fossey, for dominance in the family group. Now, he must be moved to keep the peace, so he's heading to the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago, where he'll join up with a bachelor group.
Well, keep us posted on his how he's doing as well, Dr. Day. That'll be interesting.
Yeah, it sure will.
Yes.
Because we know how gorillas are. We know those personalities. Each gorilla has its own special little personality. All right, well, let's head off to Chris's part of the country since she's our guest tonight. We haven't talked to her for a while. We're kind of excited about it.
Yes, we are.
So let's hit Fairbanks. Let's start out there.
Okay.
Now, she can probably tell us about this. Now, geese have been spotted at the partially frozen Clearwater Lake in Delta, which means that Creamer's Field will soon see some activity. The Department of Fish and Game biologist Lori Boick says geese typically arrive about a week to 10 days before they're spotted in the Delta. Now, the field will be plowed next week, and grain will be spread on April the 7th.
Are these Canadian geese?
I'm assuming that they are.
Wow.
Chris?
Yes.
Canadian geese.
Yeah. See, they never leave here.
Yeah.
We have a million of them in our state, and golf courses just love them.
Yes, yes. I work next to a golf course, and I can hear guns going off every day. All right. Well, while we're there in Alaska, let's head off to Kodiak. Now, with spring here and the bears emerging from their dens, biologist Larry Van Dale says it's time for homeowners to keep busy to keep bears from coming around. What's lying around that we forgot about when the snow hit? Well, that there could be bird seeds brewed about, garbage that the dogs got into, and then got covered by snow.
Oh, my.
Right?
Yes.
Prepared.
It all makes sense.
Chris, would you like to add to that?
That's a big problem every spring, particularly the bird feeders. That people have out, so that where everyone's always being warm to make sure they get those in before the bears come out.
Yeah, you don't think about bears and birdseed.
That's brutal.
Yeah.
No, but they're pretty hungry when they come out here.
Yes.
All right, let's head off to Royal Oak, Michigan, for another Alaska story. Three orphan grizzly bears that came to the Detroit Zoo in December have made their zoo debut. Mike, Thor, and Bo spent the winter denned up as they would in the wild. Now, the three were captured by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game after their mother was shot and killed by a poacher.
Well, good for them.
Yeah, the cuties got a new start.
Yes, that's fantastic.
All right, now, do you remember the last time Chris was on the show? I asked her when the best time to see the Northern Lights was.
I believe I do.
And her response was?
I forgot the answer.
Chris?
Well, it has to be dark.
It has to be at night, that's right.
Right, which we don't have much during the summertime. But now, today, now would be still a very good time to potentially see Northern Lights.
Well...
And that's the most beautiful thing. All right, now let's finish up the Wild World News with the fact of the day.
Uh-oh.
We're talking something that you don't get to see in Alaska very often, the saguaro cactus. Now, this is pretty interesting. Cactus plants are the slowest growing plants on Earth. Now, one kind of cactus, the saguaro, grows about 1 inch in the first 10 years of its life.
Oh, my.
Now, the saguaro doesn't grow a branch until it's 16 years old and doesn't begin to flower until it's almost 60 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
I had no idea, Dr. Day.
Well, I just wanted to let you know, and that's the Wild World News for March 29th.
Well, once again, a fine job done by Dr. Henry Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in the capital of Indiana, Indianapolis, and we always appreciate his efforts. And great job again tonight, as always. I want you to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and our brand-new Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, filled with photos and information about our animal family. Also, RadioMom.fm, the home of the Radio Mom Shop, where you can save 50, 60, 70% on vacations, restaurants, and a variety of other goods and services. And why not listen to my show on the Internet? The 70s on Sunday, 12 to 7, each Sunday at RadioMom.fm. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. We call it God's Country. Go to their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. Those are a few of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
Way up north, to Alaska, to go north, the rush is on. Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92 with George Pratt, his partner, and brother Billy, too. They crossed the Yukon River and found the Bonanza Gold below that old white mountain, just a little southeast of Nome. Sam crossed the majestic mountains to the valleys far below. He talked to his team of Huskies as he mushed on through the snow, with the Northern Lights a-running wild in the land of the midnight sun. Yes, Sam McCord was a mighty man in the year of 1901. Where the river is winding, big nuggets they're finding. North to Alaska, we're going north, the rush is on. Way up north, way up north. North to Alaska, we're going north, the rush is on. lonely, lonely man. I'd trade all the gold that's buried in this land for one small band of gold to place on sweet little Jenny's hand. 'Cause a man needs a woman to love him all the time. Remember, Sam, a true love is so hard to find. I'd build for my Jenny a honeymoon home below that old white mountain, just a little southeast of Nome, where the river is winding, big nuggets they're finding. North to Alaska, I go north, the rush is on. North to Alaska, I go north, the rush is on. Way up north, way up north, way up north.
Oh my gosh, God bless God, Johnny Horton. Our guest tonight from probably one of the most incredible places in the entire world, Denali National Park Preserve. We got the main person on, public information officer. She's been on the program before. Our good friend up in cold Alaska, Chris Pfister. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening to you. Thanks for having me back.
Wow, we were so excited, and it was such a fine program. And I have to tell you, I thought about you guys most of our winter, because we basically had no winter, and we heard these tremendous reports of all the snow that was piled up in Alaska.
You know, we certainly have had a winter up here, which is, I mean, there are benefits to it and negative aspects. I think sometimes people have short memories. Our snowpack here on the north side of the Alaska Range wasn't as huge as the reports you were hearing about Anchorage and Cordova and Valdez. They get the benefit of those storms coming right off the ocean, and so lots of moisture. The Alaska Range blocks that here. But our snowpack is probably a little over average here, and we have a fair amount on the ground for this time of the year, which is pretty exciting, because it still affords great opportunities for cross-country skiing, mushing, snowshoeing.
So what is a snowpack right now? Do you have any idea?
In terms of depth here around park headquarters, maybe a couple of feet at most.
Oh.
It's days like today and yesterday when it gets above freezing and things are starting to actually settle and consolidate, which they don't do during the main parts of the winter here. But now that the days are getting long enough, we see that. But we're seeing our road crew who are out plowing the park road. We started that the middle of March. They're running into depths of anywhere from regular depths, 3 to 5 feet, then, of course, drifts that are more, like 10 feet or so in some places. We had some pretty significant winds in January when we had a lot of the bigger storms.
Those snow crews are a different breed of individuals, aren't they?
Yes, they are, but they love it.
I'll bet they do. Gosh, it would have to be breathtaking. I've never had the opportunity. I'm determined to get up there before I leave this great place, but it's everyone I've ever talked to that's been to Alaska, they just said it's so big. I mean, the first thing, you know, we talk about Rocky Mountain National Park, and I think one of the mountains in Alaska would cover Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado.
Yeah, everything, certainly. We have a lot of land up here, and that's certainly one of the prime factors, part of the reason I'm here, is just this amazing landscape that has all this great wildlife in it, and also a lot because of the people here. Definitely, it's people need to be hardy, and we're all very different, and so there's a lot of different opinions and individuals, and I like that about Alaska.
You probably don't see too many folks because they're so oriented with the outdoors. The outdoors is their life. People that are, I don't know how to put this, heavy, a little plump.
No, I mean, remember, most of Alaska's, more than half of Alaska's population is very urban. I mean, half of Alaska's population lives in Anchorage, and Anchorage has all the stuff of a regular city, including, unfortunately, all those fast food outlets. So there are certainly people, because there are enough inside activities that people can participate in, and with the internet and satellite TV, people can actually sit inside and not do a lot of outside activity year-round here, if that's what they choose to do. So I won't say that we're necessarily any better on that scale.
Oh, okay.
Not to be punny or anything like that.
Okay, just out of curiosity, have you ever eaten at a McDonald's before?
Oh, sure. There is a McDonald's in Fairbanks. I don't eat there very often. Actually, there are probably at least two, maybe three McDonald's in Fairbanks. But Fairbanks is 2 hours from me, so it is not something that I do on a regular basis. But that's where I go in every 2 or 3 weeks to get groceries and things. So on occasion, I may have a McDonald's.
Oh, there you go.
It's certainly present here.
Okay, what's the biggest challenge, and how do you prepare for winter in Alaska along the Brooks Range and Denali National Park?
I think the biggest challenge is just making sure that you're prepared for certainly the extreme temperatures, the cold. So making sure that anything you depend upon for transportation, say a car, is winterized, that you have winter gear in the car with you at all times, just because you don't know when the car might potentially break down. Cold temperatures are very hard on things like fan belts. When it gets to be 40 below or so, we actually don't need to come into work when it's minus 45 or colder.
Oh.
We don't need to come into work first thing in the morning, and we can wait to see if it warms up a little bit by midday, whether or not we will be off just a half a day or stay the whole, because of the potential dangers of being out on the road and getting stranded because of the difficulty on the vehicle itself. So just having, again, thinking about all the things you need, your plug-in set up for your car, you know, having it on a timer, thinking about making sure you have enough fuel or whatever you use to heat your house or cabin, whether it be wood or fuel oil, making sure that you can keep access into your property so that, you know, you can continue to get those deliveries, or maybe you might be someplace where you're going to get one delivery for the season and then you have to make sure that that lasts the entire time. So preparing for the cold, having, you know, your gear and that sort of thing. And then I think the other thing is just preparing for that decreasing amount of light that affects people in different ways. And some people deal with it by going away for the winter, sort of migrating south like some of the wildlife. others deal with it in different ways, whether it be using lights, you know, that are for people with seasonal affective disorder or SAD, or just trying to stay active, keeping a regular, getting out as much as you can, getting out during those the short days and during that hours of daylight that we do have available. So we deal with it in different ways, but staying active and keeping yourself mentally and physically active, I think, is a big key in dealing with what for us are for me, often the darkest time of the year is not even the coldest or the shortest days. Will be maybe in November if we don't have much snow cover on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But once we get snow with all that reflecting light, it really, even though it's gotten dark by 4 or 4:30 or whatever, and shorter days, even before that, we have a good hour plus of twilight on either side. So even a short day will, on those shortest days, it will be about 4.5 hours, but we have a good hour of somewhat light on either end of that. And then with the light reflecting off the snow, it really doesn't seem that dark. It's actually pretty cool being able to walk out, particularly with a bright moon, and it just everything just seems to glow outside there. So, you know, we find different ways to make sure that we can get through that time. But this time of the year is amazing because it's just lots of light. We're gaining 7 minutes a day. We have over 13 hours of daylight now, and we're not that far past the equinox, and it's getting more and more, and the sun is rising higher in the sky. And so even if it will get cold, it was minus 25 at my house last week one morning, but it won't last that long, and
yeah.
It doesn't seem that bad when you're not having to walk around with a headlamp or because it's still dark and won't be light for at least a couple more hours. So the light makes a big difference.
I was going to ask you, so the shortest amount of daylight is 4.5 hours through the year.
For where I am here, right,
mm-hmm.
because we're down below the Arctic Circle. We're a couple
mm-hmm.
hundred miles south of that. So we do see, the days are short, but we do see the sun, unlike people north of the Arctic Circle, where that sun won't be visible for potentially a couple of months.
Wow, that would have to be, that would take a different individual to survive. Well, Eskimos.
Yeah, it's different, you know. I mean, they'll get a glow, but they just won't actually see the sun because, you know, it isn't coming that far high enough above the horizon. So it just, again, takes something you just get used to, but then on the opposite side of the scale, we'll have lots of light come summertime.
Is there a favorite time of the year for you? Is this it?
You know, I enjoy all of the seasons up here. I'll have to say, fall for me, and fall for us is like the end of August, early September, because that's when the colors on the tundra are just amazing. So what you have, I grew up in Ohio, so what you have in terms of the eastern deciduous forest, so above ground, our colors are mostly on the ground itself because of the low-growing tundra plants, but they'll turn beautiful shades of crimson, various shades of reds, orange, yellows, and there will be other, you know, we do have like birches and aspens that will, so some trees that will, the leaves will change color, but you'll have all this amazing ground cover that changes into these glorious colors and contrasted with the dark green of the coniferous trees. And to me, that's my favorite time of the year just because I love those colors. But on the other hand, I love Marches. It will lead into April soon, which means that once we start getting into a breakup, that the bare areas will be becoming greater and greater, and so it will be more difficult to ski because you'll just have to take your skis off in various places. And then the rivers will start opening up by later in April or early May. And we'll actually start seeing things greening up. And I enjoy watching that, too, because it happens so fast. Usually around Memorial Day weekend is when we actually will start to see the bushes and shrubs and trees leafing out. And because the days are so long at that point, you almost can watch it happen. So there's such beauty to all the seasons. And summer seems to be the fleetingest, I think, because we go from spring and then we'll have summer, but then there already will be hints of fall by, say, early August with yellows showing up in the vegetation. So, yeah, I enjoy them for what they're worth, I guess.
You know, in the spring here, we watch for the red-winged blackbird. When that shows up, that's usually an indication that, hey, spring is just around the corner or it's in full bloom. Is there a particular type of wildlife that tells you that spring is here?
Well, you already mentioned one, the geese. Yeah, and we don't see them specifically here, but certainly that's a big sign of spring for the interior. The other are the snow buntings.
Oh.
So for us, that is the first really migratory bird that we'll see around here, and that will be, again, sometime next month. By the time they make it to, they'll hit places like Fairbanks first, and then they make it down here.
Excuse my ignorance. Do they change plumage coloring through the season?
They do. Their winter plumage, if I remember, I just haven't seen them. And actually, the first time I saw them and was in winter in Michigan, and they're more black and white then. But they white bodies with black wings with some white on them, and they tend to be a little bit browner as they change into their summer breeding plumage.
So, if someone now we have listeners from around the world, and I assume that someone has thought about visiting the wilds of Alaska, what's the best time to go to Alaska, do you think, for your tourist?
Most of our visitors will come here during the summer, because they're interested in seeing more wildlife. Again, the bears are still sleeping. Some of the animals aren't here because they've migrated south for the winter. Typically, most of our visitors are going to be here sometime from about the end of May until the beginning part of September, say Labor Day. You know, our park facilities, the majority of the facilities, you know, the things that we have here in the park, they'll open mid-May, as will facilities that are outside of the park, lodges, stores, you know, food services, that sort of thing. They're open from mid-May until about mid-September.
We're talking to Chris Pfister. She's the Denali National Park and Preserve Public Information Officer. So she's given us a pretty good idea of what's involved with visiting Alaska, and is always a great program. We're going to take a short break. Folks, you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland-urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio. We hope everybody's having a great evening. What a wonderful guest tonight. We're going back to Denali National Park and Preserve with Chris Pfister in just a few moments. And I've got some questions about wildlife that we've talked about a little bit earlier on our program. Well, I should say, I think it was last week, so we're going to discuss that with her. So stick around. I hope you have a good seat and a cold beverage. And remember, tell your friends about our program. And all shows are available for free download after the live broadcast. Just go to our website, www.blogtalkradio.com/Larry-Batson. And that is spelled with two T's. We'd also like to thank iKids Fishing, first kids fishing show in the USA, starring kids, teaching kids how to fish. 40 million fishermen spending, get this, $45 billion a year. The iKids Fishing Show is a keeper. More info at We Want You Cottages at Chautauqua Lake in western New York. That website is www.wewantchu.com. It is one of America's finest fishing resorts. Also, the Tire Service Plus and owner Jerry Jones taking care of America's auto maintenance needs. They keep our animal truck on the road, traveling thousands of miles with our wild animal ambassadors. And we encourage you to give him a call at 317-243-0700 and tell him, hey, thanks for being an underwriter for Larry Batson's Wild World. It makes it possible for us each week to have these wonderful guests. And we also like to thank our individual underwriters that help us out, such as Jeannie Harold and Harley Gines, who both contributed. You can become an individual underwriter. Go to my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and contact me, personal message me. I'll tell you how easy it is. We'd love to have you aboard and become an individual underwriter. We also want to remind everyone that this half of Larry Batson's Wild World is brought to you by the first annual Chautauqua Lake Bigfoot Expo, happening May the 6th at Chautauqua Suites in Mayville, New York. You want to be there because from the Discovery Channel's Monster Quest, Melissa Hovey, Steve Calls, Bigfoot researcher Billy Willard, and yours truly will be there, along with the Wild World staff. So we encourage everyone to go up May 6th to the Chautauqua Suites in Mayville, New York. The phone number is 716-789-3383, or go to ChautauquaLakeBigfootExpo.com. Those are a few of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on this wonderful network called Blog Talk Radio.
Way up north, way up north, north to Alaska, to go north, for us is
it's on. North to Alaska, go north, the rush is on. Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92. With George Pratt, his partner, and brother Billy, too. They crossed.
I love that. I was encouraging Dr. Day to sing along with North Dual.
I wanted to, but I thought I'd be good tonight.
Our guest tonight, Chris Pfister, all the way up in Denali National Park. We've set up a long string with a can to talk to her tonight, so we're glad she was able to join us. Now, Chris, we did a story, I believe it was last week. Now, do you have polar bears in Denali?
No, they're much further north.
Much further. Because we had done
Up, up along the coastal areas of the state. So, I mean, much further north.
Much further north. Okay. Well, we had a story, and well, I should say Dr. Day's staff had a story where they were having polar bears and grizzly bears interbreeding. And they're creating some pretty unusual-looking bear. But I guess that doesn't happen in Denali. You have no polar bear.
No, but I have heard of that, yes. There have been at least a couple of instances, I believe, where they seem to have found a bear that is the result of that very unusual breeding.
So of all your... Now, how long have you been at Denali?
I have been here since 1995.
Wow. So what is your most extraordinary experience viewing wildlife?
Oh, wow. It's so hard to say because it just, when you have a really great sighting somewhere, I've been excited to have been able to see not just the animals that are often seen here, some great grizzly bear sightings. I got to see black bears in the park last summer, which was a first. They're not as common, and they live in the more wooded areas of the park on sort of either end of the park road, so further west, and they're just not, you don't see them very often. So I was very excited actually to see a couple of them when I was further out in the park last summer. We've had several years, well, I'd say the last maybe 3 years or so of increased lynx sightings because the snowshoe hare cycle was at its peak. And so then the numbers of lynx increased, and so we've just been able to see great numbers of lynx. And that's going to decrease now because the hare population has dropped. I mean, as they do, they're very cyclical. And so the lynx this winter definitely had a hard time finding food because there aren't that many hares around now. And so consequently, there will be fewer lynx. But you'll still see them on an irregular basis. I've been very fortunate to have seen wolverine a couple of times here in the park, and they're very elusive. Several friends here are saying how they had not ever seen one yet. And so it's I feel very fortunate to have been able to see some cool things here. And I've been able to travel to other areas of the state, going out to see aquatic life, and going out to some of the other far areas to see wildlife, too. So certainly is an interest of mine. That's part of the reason I'm up in Alaska.
Well, the wolverine, now that you brought that up, because I was going to ask you if you'd ever had the opportunity to see one. But we had on National Geographic writer Doug Chadwick, who's done a lot of research with wolverines.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so impressed with those. He told us, that a wolverine will go in places that a mountain goat wouldn't even consider.
They certainly can move around, and I watched one actually move across the whole face of this mountain. I guess not like a sheer rock face, but just moving, and it went out at a diagonal, and we watched it for, it was probably at least a couple of miles as it went diagonally, just moving constantly the entire time, and it would stop every now and then. Kind of, you could watch it was catching its breath. You could see it was panting, and there was nothing following it. We couldn't see that it was chasing anything. It was just, we watched it for a good 15-20 minutes as it just moved across its whole face, and it impressed me that it could move at that clip up what would have taken me much longer.
they're just absolutely incredible. I mean, that was the first thing that he said. He said they'll venture in places that your goats and sheep won't even consider. I said they're just and you've just proven it right there. Can you remember the first time you ever had a chance to see wolves in a park?
I'm trying to remember the first time. Boy, it was certainly when I first started working here. It would have been one of the first summers, so it would have been, say, I got here in 95, and it would have been the summer of 96. You know, I'm sure it would have been something from the road. I can't remember the exact first time because I've just been able to see them many times after that. But mm-hmm. Seeing it was very exciting. I think the most exciting thing for me, though, was hearing one, hear one howl.
Mm-hmm.
That was, it sent chills up my spine. It was just, you know, it was later in the day, so evening, it's still light, so in the summertime, and just to all of a sudden hear this, I couldn't even see the animal, but to hear this howl coming out from somewhere out in the valley down below me, and mm-hmm. That I remember actually more than the first sighting.
I assume that wolves are a little more respected in that part of the country versus farther south when you get into the cattle country and so forth.
There's a big controversy up here. Certainly the state has some different management practices. They are trying to maximize hunting opportunities for both sport and subsistence hunters, people who depend on caribou and moose for food. And, you know, wolves are not threatened or endangered up here, so there are lots mm-hmm. of them. So, I mean, there's a controversy as to how they should be managed. I mean, there are programs where the state actually will go in and actively kill wolves to enhance hunting opportunities. And so, yeah, that's not done here in the park, of course. And, we work with the state in terms of trying to hopefully mitigate. Our concern is potentially what would potentially be impacts on the park's wolf population, because they do move outside the park and there's recruitment that comes into the park from outside, mm-hmm. and how that would impact our visitors' ability to be able to potentially see them. I mean, that will vary from year to year. I mean, there's no guarantee that a visitor coming here will see a wolf. Some years it possibly is more likely because there have been wolf packs that have denned closer to the road, and once mm-hmm. they come out of the dens, they're often the area that they often hunt in, much of it is more open, you know, tundra, mm-hmm. and so it's easier to see them in that type of a habitat. But some years they don't den in those sites, and so they're not as frequently seen, and so it really varies. But it certainly is an animal that visitors enjoy seeing here, along with the grizzly bears and the sheep and the other species that we have here.
Well, wolves have such a positive impact on that part of the country where they're basically left alone, per se. Because one of the most interesting things that was presented to me by Doug Chadwick was, well, when they introduced them in Yellowstone in Montana, Wyoming, how they kept the elk moving and they would not overgraze areas, and how the wildlife just blossomed, and the big changes that would occur when the wolves were introduced.
Yeah, they certainly can have many benefits, and depending on what your interest is, and again, there are people here who are interested in putting a moose or caribou in their freezer, and wolves definitely have it take a toll on them, and so mm-hmm. It somehow, you know, that you try to find that balance, but at least within the park, you know, they are able to roam freely and do what they would normally be doing out there.
Sure. What is the procedure with bears? Do you have problems in the summertime with tourists and bears?
Typically, very rarely. We do put a lot of information out there, just in terms of actually we warn in all of our interpretive programs. Like if you go on a ranger-led walk or something, you will get a warning about not just what to do if you should encounter a bear while you're out walking around, but what if you encounter a moose. I mean, moose can be more dangerous than bears because they tend to be in the areas where humans are. I mean, people think of them, they're large deer, but they are very large, and particularly a cow moose with her calf is very protective of that calf, and they will come running right at you, and you don't want to be – I mean, people have died from being trampled by moose, and so – you need to get out of their space very quickly, and you can run from them. And so the big difference is you can run from a moose. I mean, you just need to get away from wherever they are. But you shouldn't run from a bear because you'll elicit that chase response. But we have relatively few incidents in our backcountry. No one has ever been. Most of the bears that people encounter here are grizzlies, mm-hmm. even though we do have black bears. We've never had a bear cause fatality here in the park. It's been many, many years since we had any kind of a mauling, and that was, I mean, the very serious mauling took place, I want to say it was back in the 70s. I mean, there have been other instances where bears have slightly injured somebody, but, I mean, so significant that they had to be rushed to the hospital, I think, you know, maybe a slight puncture wound on a hand or something like that. So we do provide a lot of information to particularly backcountry users, so people getting a wilderness permit, who are those people that are going to be spending the night out there. They go through a whole orientation that talks about what to do for wildlife encounters, but also other types of hazards out there, which include environmental, dealing with cool, wet, windy conditions, you know, hypothermia, and also crossing rivers. We don't have any bridges in our backcountry areas, so you're going to have to cross streams on your own. So, and there are techniques that will aid you in doing that and so knowing what you're doing. So we provide a lot of information to try to mitigate that. And we're very fortunate. Our bears here, our backcountry users also carry canisters. The food is carried in these bear-resistant food containers or cylinders, 18 inches high or so, maybe, say, 8-9 inches in diameter. And so we typically don't have problems with bears getting acclimated or habituated to getting human food, which is a big concern, obviously.
You know, that's really saying something. That just commends your staff so much, because there are probably more bears in Denali per square mile than Yellowstone or Glacier. And with very few incidents, that just shows how important education is when dealing with these animals in the wild.
Yeah, education is certainly important. I mean, certainly Glacier and Yellowstone will have more visitors potentially, and there might be some other issues there too, development around the park that might encourage bears to have somewhat become habituated. And of course, then they have trails, which make it easy for people. It's easier to walk along a trail and not necessarily be paying attention to what you're doing, whereas we have very few trails in Denali. We have some developed trails near our entrance area and around a couple of the developments along the park road, but most of the park doesn't have formal trails. And so when you're route finding and having to pay attention to your footing, because there isn't like a nice prepared surface there, you're just paying more attention to your surroundings too. So making sure that you're making plenty of noise if you happen to be in an area that's brushy or where you don't have much visibility, where it's easier to kind of zone out, I think, along trails. And potentially that's another reason why they might have some problems there. I mean, we're fortunate. I think all those parks try to have very good educational efforts, but there just are more people, and just perhaps the opportunities are different there that contributes to some of the instances they've had down south.
Well, I think, too, that the people that come to your part of the world, they're a little bit more attuned and experienced with the outdoors and what to deal with. What would you do if you ran into a bear within, 20 yards or so?
Boy, well,
that's close.
That's very close. I guess, yeah. I would see how the bear reacted to me. I mean, I would immediately start making noise. I mean, making myself look larger. If I was with somebody, we would get together. I would try again, see what it's doing. I mean, I might just start talking to it and just say, "Hey, bear, just me," and just trying to back slowly away and get it. Particularly if we were on a trail. I mean, I actually have run into bear. I'm trying to think of the last one I ran into, walking on a trail. I could see the movement ahead of me, and at first I thought it was just a hiker, and then I realized it was a bear. And it was further than 20 yards, but it was probably 35 yards away or so. And I started making noise immediately. I mean, it stopped, and then I just actually started just slowly backing away. And I was going to back off because it was coming toward me on the trail. It was walking on the trail. But then it stopped, and then it actually sat down and it kind of considered, and then it turned around and it went the other direction. And I thought, okay, great, because I was trying to go that way, and I went a little bit. I waited for a few minutes, let it get ahead of me, and then I had to go up a little rise, so I couldn't really see very far along the trail where it had disappeared. And so I just made lots of noise while I let it know that I was coming. And I actually saw it finally a little bit further down the trail. I was walking to this lake, and it was on the edge of the lake, and then it got in the lake and it swam across.
Well, they're so smart, and that's what people I don't think realize. I was just talking to a friend of mine. He thought that the bears were as smart as the great apes, except they don't have the facial expressions. Because, to give you an example, Chris, I have two black bears that I've used in programs for years with our school kids. And last summer, they had this huge trough that we fill with water. And they had turned the trough over. In fact, it was completely upside down. And I'm walking by their enclosure, and I holler at them. I say, "Now, guys, girls, you need to turn that trough over. I'm going to go get the hose, and we'll fill it up." Of course, I was just thinking to myself, well, I'm talking to a bear, having a general conversation. That's pretty dumb. But I came back within 10 minutes, and the male bear, he had the trough turned right side up, and he was sitting in it like a person would sit with his elbows on the side of the trough, waiting for me to go get the hose and fill it up. I mean, that's just how smart they are.
Yeah, no, I think they can certainly, they show that they can learn a lot of things out there. They certainly can remember where they found food. So
that's
always real difficult once a bear has gotten into human food. They'll remember that for a long time, no matter what you try as a deterrent. They have all these mechanisms you can try to help it unlearn that. But, boy, they'll remember that reward for a long time.
Well, it's pretty much that if anybody feeds a bear, they're giving the bear the death sentence, because he's at least in the lower 40. It may not be so much in Alaska because of the bears, but I've been reminded that so many times. And do you have a particular moment? Now, I'm thinking the tourists are much smarter when they come up to Alaska, where you thought that was a dumb thing for that tourist to do.
No, I mean, I don't think most of our visitors, people do things when they don't know any better, and sometimes, and I can't think of anything that strikes me. I mean, I'm always, people are always coming up and they say, well, I bet this, this is a stupid question, and, I bet you for, and it's just like, well, the fact that you're asking me a question is, even if it's something, you don't know it, and you shouldn't be expected to know things about this place because it's very different from where you've come from. So
sure.
I always appreciate, I would rather they ask a question and, as opposed to not. And again, people will do something that they don't know any better, and not deliberate, and nothing comes to mind per se.
Well, you've never had a question. I can remember a ranger telling me in Colorado once that a gal came up completely straight faced, and she said, "When did the deer turn to elk?"
Yeah, no, I worked in Glacier Bay National Park for some summers, and people would ask, what elevation we were at, but that was totally understanding. You'd be on it, because we would get on the ships that would come into Glacier Bay and do programs on them, and you'd look and try to figure out which deck you were on, and it's like, well, I think we're about 30 feet now. Because you were in a long, narrow fjord surrounded by land, I mean, they had kind of lost the perception, sort of lost reality that they were on the ocean, because it was no longer a larger body of water, it was a smaller body of water. So again, I mean, it's easy to, and I always used to think that, people would come up here and they're often on a busy schedule. They may be moving around, whether they're on a ship and they're going from port to port, or here, I mean, they're on their land. Many of them may have been on a cruise, or they're going to go on a cruise. They're on a land package, and so they're going to many different places. Many of them are sleep deprived because it hasn't gotten dark, and so their time clock, whether they've just traveled up from Indiana or Michigan or Ohio or someplace, and their time clocks are off anyway, and then they can't sleep well because they can't figure out what time it is because it's not getting dark, and it's just, there are all these things that potentially can throw. So, still, the fact that they're asking questions is great.
You're right.
And like I said,
Absolutely. Do you have a favorite part of the park?
I like to get to the more open areas, and so we're about 2,000 feet here at headquarters, and it is wooded here, but we start getting into, our tree line is somewhere around 2,800 feet, so you don't have to go very far out the road, so about mile 9, we're mile 3 here, things start to open up, so I like the more open areas. It's just easier to walk around, particularly when it's real low. tundra vegetation. So the higher areas of the park, say, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 feet, are just those tiny alpine flowers that survive under these just harsh conditions. And so you have to get down close. But they put on this beautiful show. Some of them, you know, big, but they're in like clumps and things. And I just, so I think, you know, those higher elevations of the park are my favorites for exploring. But I also like, you know, along the rivers and things. At this time of the year, it's just so easy to get around. I love exploring now because it's so easy to get around in places because vegetation, much of it's still covered by snow, and the rivers are still frozen. So it just makes travel so much easier, which, I mean, you can appreciate all the when the original settlers, and also obviously the original inhabitants of this land, when they are here, it was just easier for them to move around in the winter.
Sure. I assume you're a photographer. Do you take a gazillion pictures?
I don't.
You don't.
I have many friends who are professional photographers. Uh-huh. Many people who are not professionals, but they just enjoy it. And I, maybe over the years, I've had cameras over the years, but I enjoy capturing it in my mind. And I know I wouldn't be able to capture it the way people who really spend time with it could.
Sure.
And so it's just easier for me to keep it in my mind and not have to fiddle with the, even though I know cameras now are so easy that they'll do all the focusing and everything for you. Mm-hmm. But it's just, no, I'm not a photographer. And
what about
my
fishing?
Friends are often appalled.
Do you go fishing?
I fish if I have to. This is probably blasphemous, I know. I don't consider it recreational. I enjoy going out with people who are fishing. I love being out in that environment, and whether it be out on a body of water or along a stream or river. And I will fish if I have to, if we need to get something to eat.
Oh, there you go.
But I don't consider it recreational. Yeah.
Well, I was so silly. We had a friend on the show that has a lodge in Alaska, and I asked him, I said, gosh, it's just got to be tremendous to go fishing and have a shoreline lunch with a fish he just caught just right out of those cold Alaskan waters. And he said, let me tell you, he says, we don't have shoreline lunches. They attract bears. And he says, that presents a big problem. So I thought to myself, well, yeah, I didn't even dummy me would go up there and anticipate a shoreline lunch, and I have all sorts of four-legged company.
Yeah, that's true. There are some fishing areas that where you are having to particularly compete with the bears. But I actually have been able to go out when just working in other parks and being out on the outer coast, say, of Katmai, and we were out on a patrol, and we would eat a shoreline lunch, you know, later on, you know, not right then immediately, but actually further out where we knew that closer to the ocean itself, where we knew that eventually that the scraps would get taken up with the tide.
Sure.
It was far away from our campsite. But, yeah, no, we had to be very careful about that because it was still, you know, we were always sort of looking around. But there was nice because there weren't very many people out there. The fishermen would come in for the day, but they would leave. And so the bears had plenty of fish also.
Well, I have to say, Chris, what a pleasure it must be for the visitors that come up to Denali that have the opportunity to interact with you, and because you have such a wonderful way to express yourself. We talk Colorado, God's country. You know, Alaska is just, I can't even imagine. It has to be absolutely breathtaking. And one day, I'm telling you now, you may hear a knock on your cabin door. And myself and Dr. Day may be up invading the wilds of Alaska. And Alaska will never be the same again, I don't think.
Well, I hope you have the opportunity to get up here. This is an amazing place, and I feel very fortunate that I can share my knowledge with our park visitors, and that they can get up to this place too, because it is beautiful.
Oh, yes. And Denali's so lucky to have you. You've always been such a great ambassador. Henry Day, we have to go up north, way up north.
I know, just to spend a few minutes with Chris. What a world of information.
Oh, my Lord, yes.
And Chris, we have a lot of listeners in Ohio. Where in Ohio were you born?
I was born in Akron. I grew up in Barberton, Ohio.
Born in Akron.
And my mom still lives there, so I get back there at least a couple of times a year.
Oh, that must be sobering.
There are aspects of the East that the Eastern deciduous forest that I really miss. So it's always a pleasure to get back there.
Well, you're just being kind. Our guest tonight, Chris Pfister, public information officer for Denali National Park. Chris, we're going to call you again.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it.
Oh my Lord, what a great show! We'd also like to thank our studio producer Melissa Hovey and, of course, our technical engineer Wayne Larson. As always, so kind to come up with the music for us, Scott Carney. And Dr. Henry Day, our news director with the Wild World News. An outstanding show, Dr. Day.
Yes, it was. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we encourage everyone to tell your friends, download our shows, all of our shows. We've got some great ones, including tonight, absolutely free, at www.blogtalkradio.com/Larry-Batson. And also remind everyone on May the 6th, the first annual Chautauqua Lake Bigfoot Expo at the Chautauqua Suites in Mayville, New York. Let me give you that phone number. Write it down so you can get your information, tickets, lodging, 716-789-3383. This is Larry Batson. You've been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.